Hello and welcome to this, the last edition of Risky Business for 2008. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's edition of Risky Business is sponsored by Tenable Network Security, makers of fine information security software. You can find them at tenablesecurity.com. By the time you hear this, I will be off on a surfing holiday, and I won't be back on air, so to speak, until February. I'll probably throw up a couple of RuxCon presentations, but that's about it, and I'll be doing a little bit of work on the new website in January. There'll be blogs, forums, a second podcast, and much, much more. So that's all, you know, pretty exciting for us. For listeners outside of Australia, I should explain that nothing actually happens here in January. The whole place pretty much stops. It's quite fantastic. So today we'll be joined by Marcus Ranham a bit later in the show, but before that we're looking back, way, way back. It is, after all, our year in review show, which is why you're not hearing our normal music. Instead of going out with a regular show, I thought we'd take a look back over the year that was. And 2008 was a hell of a time to be in information security, with some surprising issues grabbing the agenda. I'll be going through the news as we saw it over the last 12 months and naming the winners in a few categories in our highly unofficial awards. The Risky Business Awards, as judged by our select panel of me. There'll be the most hyped security issue, best research, and best tool. Well, where to start? Why not with the noisiest security issue of the whole year? While arguably not the most important issue of 2008, Dan Kaminsky's DNS bugs takes out Risky Business's Pwning the Media Award for most blatantly alarmist reporting on a security issue. Way to go, media. While Kaminsky was busy holding on to his secret exploit code that would destroy the world, HD Moore just wrote up an exploit and released it, allowing us to interview him a short time later about his decision to fully disclose an active exploit the media was touting as extremely serious.
Yeah. So tell us about these exploits that you've coded up, because, I mean, Kaminsky hasn't even come out publicly and said what it is yet, has he?
Right. You know, we don't know whether the bugs that we have are actually the real bugs or not. We just know that what we have works, and that's really all we really care about.
Wouldn't it be funny if it was a completely separate issue and you've just, like, dropped O-Day exploit code onto the net?
It would be, but I'm pretty sure we figured it out.
Yeah.
We also took the opportunity to replay the highlights of Dan's pre-Black Hat webinar about the flaws.
Welcome to today's webcast, Dan Kaminsky's DNS Discovery, brought to you by Black Hat and United Business Media, LLC.
So, introduction, who am I? You probably know by now. In my pursuit of making the internet faster, I may have had some unintentional side effects. Look, I'm not the only smart guy on the internet. Bernard, would you mind holding on to it till Black Hat? He's like, no problem, man. You go make the internet more secure. I was not intentionally seeking to cause anything that could break the net. Actually, I was trying to make the internet faster. To the point that I'm feeling like a deadhead. By the ground where the fruit grows
best. I get a taste, but I never get the rest. Well, I can't just... By the time Anton Capella and Alex Pilosov demonstrated their BGP man-in-the-middle attack, which was, in essence, a slight extension of existing attacks, the media was pretty much done with flapping its arms over serious security problems with internet infrastructure. Too bad, too, because you can't fix the problems in BGP with a patch. Oh well, it's nice to know the mainstream media has its priorities straight. Now, the DNS flaw wasn't the only overhyped issue of 2008. Researchers from American universities unveiled what they called cold boot attacks. These guys and gals figured out that RAM actually holds state for a couple of minutes after you switch off a machine. That turns out to be useful if you want to recover crypto keys from memory. They also figured out that if you cool the RAM with an aerosol spray before cutting its power, you'll have a good few minutes to extract all the data from RAM, hence the name cold boot attacks. Convicted computer criminal turned consultant Adrian Lamo joined Risky Business with his take.
I I think that it's being pushed more for its James Bond value and less for its actual threat level value.
Well, yeah, it has been an incredibly well-marketed attack, even complete with a snazzy YouTube video. You've seen it, right?
I actually have not seen the YouTube video. I can sort of visualize it, though. I'll tell you this. If it were not these particular researchers, I would expect a product to be on shelves next Tuesday. Ram Defender, don't let your ram get frozen.
I like it. Indeed. When I'd remembered that Adam Boileau had demonstrated a technique for reading a computer's RAM through its FireWire port, which, of course, would enable the attacker to obtain those cryptographic keys, I gave him a call to ask him if he'd release that code to the public. He obliged, and Risky Business got the exclusive.
Well, it's a tool that I wrote when I was working on the FireWire stuff that I released at RuxCon a couple of years ago. Via the FireWire stuff I was demoing, you could gain access to the memory of a remote system via FireWire. Obviously, you could read memory with that, and you could write memory with that, and you could, if you were sufficiently cunning, do relatively evil things with it. So, of course, we, being somewhat evil people, wrote a tool, myself and Brett Moore, that would allow you to, among other things, unlock a locked Windows machine or log in without a password or spawn a administrator shell at the login prompt without having to log in, merely by plugging in your FireWire cable and running a command.
We also wound up squarely in the middle of the storm when the Sydney Morning Herald wrote up the story with the headline of, get this, hack into a Windows PC, no password needed. It promptly hit Slashdot, and poor Adam's website struggled to cope as anxious bunny boilers frantically downloaded the tool in the hope they could read their boyfriend's email. A few people actually stopped Adam in the street after that one, and it's no surprise. Last week, the Sydney Morning Herald released its list of the 50 most popular stories of the year. Adam's code release came in at number 31. But the best stories of 2008 weren't necessarily the ones that got the most attention. Back in May, Risky Business was lucky enough to get the scoop on some development work HD Moore got involved in. He basically married Dino A. Dazzovi's Karma wireless tool with Metasploit, and he also wrote a bunch of extras designed to create maximum mayhem. Oh, and it was all coded up to run on the Asus E platform. The basic idea behind this thing is it listens for SSID probes, then it replies with that SSID. So if you've got any saved network that doesn't use encryption, this thing will make you connect to it. No big deal, you might think. Well, if you have a browser open, it will actually grab all of your form data and cookies from the top 500 websites on the web, and then own you through an SMB relay attack.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but this sounds like a project to create the world's most evil EPC.
Basically. Right. I mean, anything they try to do, whether it's browse the web or download email or, you know, connect via Instant Messenger or any other service that uses authentication, you can capture the authentication. You can do really evil things with regard to web pages, especially because there's so much of what you do online is secured in the browser based on what site you're going to.
So there you go, it's quite simply the most evil tool of the year and definitely deserving of the Risky Business Best Tool Award. Congratulations, HD Moore. Moore frequently popped in through 2008 with some interesting things to talk about. He also joined us to talk about IPv6 attacks. As it turns out, if someone's got an IPv6 IP and a default deny firewall, they're still highly ownable if they don't have NetFilter 6 running. Hooray!
Yeah, the neat thing about this is because all these modern operating systems have V6 enabled on the local network, and you've got now, you know, Metasploit supports it, other tools support it for breaking into these machines. If you, for example, you know, break the root password on, say, a Debian machine, or you log in with one of the cracked keys, and you log in via an IPv6 address, well, when the admin comes in and they look at their logs, they're going to see someone logging in from an IPv6 address, and they'll have no freaking idea what you're doing or who that came from. Or, you know, it just doesn't make any sense to people when they see, oh, last login from SE80:000000. Like, what the hell is that?
Exactly. Yeah.
Did an alien attack my machine?
Sleep is a stupid dream to have her get the ball. Ride a bed like a kid to breathe. I can hear the angels call. Whoa, whoa. The winner of the Risky Business Best Research Award, as selected through our rigorous process of me picking something that I thought was highly cool, well, this year it goes to Mark Dowd for exploiting the unexploitable. That's right, he figured out how to exploit some null pointer dereference bugs and developed a cross-platform exploit that owned Flash through a browser. Any browser. And yes, Flash is the most commonly installed software on the planet.
The reason there's a lot of attention drawn towards the paper is for two reasons. One is because Flash is really widely deployed, like it's available on, you know, Unix, Windows, Mac, and a range of embedded devices. And so a major vulnerability in Flash is a pretty big deal. But the other reason is that null pointer type vulnerabilities are generally not really, people don't really concentrate on them, like developers and security researchers have, except in a few specific cases, have sort of assumed that they're unexploitable for the most part. And that's not always the case, which is what this paper sort of illustrated. So if you need the frost,
2008 was a bad year for open source security. It copped an absolute shellacking. First up, it was the Debian key generation fiasco. As it turns out, cryptographic key pairs generated on Debian systems for 18 months were borderline useless thanks to some ill-conceived changes made by a Debian developer. Within a couple of weeks, the package signing boxes for Red Hat and Fedora Core were also compromised, as we found out when we discussed the matter with our regular news guest, ZDNet Australia editor, Munir Kataria. Can you imagine if this happened to Microsoft?
Oh, geez, that'd be pretty crazy, wouldn't it?
Can you imagine if Microsoft put out a press release saying, you know, some guys broke into our Windows update servers and they got our private key, but you know what? They didn't get the passphrase.
Yes, don't worry about it. Everything's fine.
Yeah, and they got into the Office server and they signed a few Trojan copies of Word, but we don't think it actually went out through the Windows update network that we know.
It's pretty poor.
It was also the year that saw serious questions raised on the effectiveness of antivirus software, particularly signature-based AV. Risky Business got the exclusive interview with Simon Howard, the organiser of the Race to Zero competition at DEF CON in Las Vegas. The Race to Zero was all about proving just how dead signature-based AV is by encouraging entrants to obfuscate existing viruses so they could get around basically all pattern-matching AV systems.
Yeah, we're just pointing out the basic flaw in signature-based AV and that it's pretty much dead, and you need to look at other means of detecting these threats, like heuristic or statistical or behaviour-based techniques, or even something like the Bit9 product, who do known good applications on your system, and anything else that comes along that it doesn't fit in with those schemes is denied, basically.
Yeah, whitelist.
So we need to think about the larger picture here for controlling antivirus when signature-based just isn't really cutting the mustard anymore.
But in the interest of fairness and to get the other side of the argument, I flew to a Kaspersky security junket in St. Petersburg to chat to the big man himself, Eugene Kaspersky, all about the future of AV.
Our vision is that the modern antivirus, modern anti-malware system have to be very complicated. They have to get more and more protection technologies into the same solution. So we are focused on that, and this is our way, our strategy of our product development.
I also spoke to his minions, which included Magnus Kolkor, who works for Kaspersky in Germany.
It's a question of tolerance. If you set up your heuristics very aggressive, to an aggressive level, it will detect almost all malware, but you will get false positives on and on and on. And so if you lower the level of aggressiveness, less malware will be detected and almost no false positives. So this is always a very difficult game. And whitelisting is an interesting approach because then you can have the best of both worlds. So you can have a high aggressiveness of your heuristics, and the whitelisting is there to help the user if a false positive comes up, so to prevent this.
So you don't see whitelisting as being an exclusive sort of solution, but it's something that allows you to really turn up the heuristics component of a full suite.
Right. So there has been a discussion ongoing, especially during the last month. So some companies are saying blacklisting is dead and whitelisting is the thing. And we think that's just stupid because we're just combining the best of both worlds. And so far, people are very happy with that.
2008 was also a tough year for the bad guys, with McColo, a somewhat shady hosting provider based in California, being shut down by their upstream providers. Because McColo hosted so many command and control channels, we saw a drop in spam levels across the globe of around 70% after the shutdown. But alas, iDefense threat analyst Kimberly Zenz told us the spammers would be back and stronger than ever, and she was right.
Well, that's actually part of the concern about things like clothing organizations like McColo, is that will they move to another organization similar, or will that sort of push the cyber criminals into the next level of sophistication, at which point it becomes that much harder to monitor and track and investigate them.
So do you think that's likely what's going to happen, that there'll be this new sort of spurt of innovation in the underworld?
McColo all by itself, no. But this is the third company this has happened to recently with pretty high profile. If they keep going on this trend, then it is going to push people into adopting already available services. They're just more complex and more difficult to use and more expensive. But, you know, for them, the issue is maximum return for minimum risk and cost. And the risk is a big part of that. So if they feel like they can't get reliable service, they will move to the next level.
I also managed to get to the GovCert security conference in the Netherlands to chat to a few of their terrific speakers. By far the most interesting was David Rice, the author of Geekonomics, The Real Cost of Insecure Software. David says insecure software is an example of market failure. We spend much more cleaning up after the design defects and bugs than it would cost to solve the defects to begin with. And Rice says governments need to get involved.
Insecure software is no longer a technology problem. It's a public policy issue. And that means, in terms of public policy, the incentives that need to be in the marketplace to give us secure software simply aren't there. And so instead of looking at it as a technological phenomenon that has to be solved by other technological phenomena, like firewalls, antivirus, etc., what we say is that this is a public policy issue. Let's not look at the technology alone. Let's also look at the incentive schemes that are out there.
2008 was also the first year that the Southern Hemisphere's premier two technical security conferences were held in one year. KiwiCon in Wellington in New Zealand and RuxCon in Sydney. And while the debate around what the best presentation was will likely rage on for some time, there's no argument about the funniest presentation. SecurityAssessment.com's Paul Craig had them rolling in the aisles when he did a double-header presentation at KiwiCon. The first item on his agenda was to release ICAT, a website that will handily hack kiosks for you.
Now, ICAT 1.1 is going to include full support for non-Windows-based kiosks. Now, the reason behind this is that I've had all of these kiosk vendors that develop Linux kiosks email me and say, oh, now, your tool's got nothing. You're focusing on Windows. You know, you can't hack me. Bull fucking shit, I can't. So I've gone out and I've hacked all the Linux kiosks and I'm going to integrate support in.
The next bit of his talk was all about his analysis of massive amounts of botnet data he'd managed to legally intercept.
I got 35 adult friend finder accounts. I got 21 swinger-related websites. Me and my friend here, Pudgy For You, she's owned. Now, at this point, I started to realize, what else do I search for? So how many people search for Paris Hilton? Fucking heaps. Heaps and heaps. The really interesting one, again, is the one at the bottom. I don't get this. So he was at a page searching for shemale, shemale sex, black shemale, shemale movies, with the term Paris Hilton. Hey, whatever. Paris Hilton's pretty popular. This guy in Australia was visiting cracker.com.au and was flicking between these two profiles. The one on the left is Exotic Anna, and the one on the right is the hot Asian transsexual with photos. And he was going to one page, going to the other, and then going back to the first one. And I was like, ooh, you're comparing which one to order.
The other big news out of New Zealand was Peter Gutman's role in pointing out the insecurity of the e-passport standard used by governments all over the world. So we had a bad start. So we wanted a game, but just strong and I stopped it all up and thought.
Well, it was actually a three-person effort to basically demonstrate that you could create a passport that would be accepted as valid by the reference implementation. So a lot of the stuff with this passport is that it was motivated very heavily by politics rather than security concerns. For example, the motivation for rushing out the e-passport wasn't any concerns about terrorism. It was because the US said, you need to do this by this date or we will impose travel sanctions on you, which will cost you a hell of a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So the threat model in this case wasn't terrorism, it was the Bush administration. And that's you know, the problem with this is that there's such a huge amount of politics tied up in this stuff, it's very hard to pull apart the politics from the technology. But one of the side effects of rushing this out in a hurry based on political pressure was that there were some compromises made that weren't necessarily, you know, the end result wasn't necessarily the best way of doing things.
Elvis Bin Laden e-passport, anyone? And speaking of crossing borders, our regular news guest Munir Kataria, who grew up in London as an immigrant, was obviously quite upset when the membership list for the ultra-right-wing British anti-immigration party BNP was leaked online.
They're fantastic people, yeah. And I'm so upset that all of their names and addresses and whatever were published online. It was just awful, awful, awful.
The poor, poor people. Yeah. And ironically, they're using the Human Rights Act, which they oppose, to try to actually put an injunction on this stuff being out there, which makes them hypocritical racist bastards, which I think is just the best. I mean, like, what colossal pricks these guys are. And what's really funny is they found a couple of them here in Australia, which is really funny. Don't you find it really ironic that a group of people who are anti-immigration have immigrated to Australia?
It is brilliant. It just, yeah. It just all falls into place as soon as you say that.
It really does. And that, everyone, is the year that was. But of course, no episode of Risky Business would be complete without a sponsor interview. But we'll stick with the year in review theme. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security, and each week we get our sponsors on the show to chat about current events. And what a finish it was to 2008. An actively exploited, unpatched Internet Explorer flaw is doing the rounds. Some smarty pantsers out there have suggested that those likely to be affected should switch to Firefox. Well, that would have been a great idea, but last week an email hit Full Disclosure that seemed to contain details of a Firefox browser vulnerability. Hooray for browser security. Now, I don't know if the Firefox flaw was legit or not, but that's hardly the point. The point is it's 2008 and browser security sucks as badly as it ever did. Joining me to discuss this miserable state of affairs is Tenable Network Security's Chief Security Officer, Marcus Ranham.
Right. Well, I mean, this is the problem with playing the penetrate and patch game. As long as you accept that browsers are going to have vulnerabilities, and as long as browsers are incredibly powerful and capable meta frameworks that can do just about anything on your system, you know, we're going to continue to have these problems. I don't understand why people are surprised.
Yeah, look, I've got to be honest and say I don't either, because I think... Do you reckon it's premature to call that the browser security battle has been lost?
Actually, I would say that the system security battle is lost when the browsers came along. You know, the browser security is kind of like it's an oxymoron. I mean, has there ever been a secure browser?
Yeah. Now that's the thing. I mean, one small thing that gives me hope is that we're starting to see a few products and technologies coming along trying to address browser security simply by sandboxing it, whether that's by putting it in a completely virtualized, you know, VM, you know, with a hypervisor running a whole, you know, OS stack just for that browser, or things like Sandboxy, which are just a little sort of virtualized file system. What do you think of that sort of stuff?
Well, I think it's a fantastic idea. I mean, here's the part where, you know, you're going to want to slap me on the head when I'm done speaking. But, you know, this is what operating systems were supposed to do.
No, I mean, I agree with you there, man. I mean, they're supposed to separate stuff, and they haven't. And that's why, you know, it almost seems like virtualization is our great hope at the moment, because it actually does separate shit properly, even though it's kind of lame that we have to run an operating system stack for every application that we want to isolate. But it looks like it works.
Yeah, well, that's basically what that is. Is that is the industry reacting to the fact that the operating system is incapable of providing separation between applications, and they have to have a whole virtual operating system. You know, it's pathetic, but yeah, I guess it works. it's going to magnify system administration costs across the board.
For now, but I just sort of get the impression that the hypervisor is going to be the new OS, and every single application you use will have its own OS stack. And it's probably just a more sensible model, don't you think?
Well, I don't think it's a more sensible model. I mean, I think, you know, essentially the hypervisor, yeah, you're right, the hypervisor becomes the new OS. I mean, what we really need is an operating system that does the things an operating system is supposed to do, and separate the application spaces, you know, memory space and stuff like that. You know, I don't know what the end game is here, but we should look at the places where we've made mistakes in the present and the past, right? And so what's going to happen? Is somebody going to figure out how to tunnel from the hypervisor, from one hypervisor framework to the other?
Well,
that's already happening.
You know, it has already happened. I mean, we've seen flaws in, I think, Parallel, Xen, and VMware all in the last month. Interestingly enough, I'm sure you're going to love this term, Marcus, but it was termed by some of the KiwiCon guys. They called it those class of vulnerabilities, which is hypervisor guest to master vulnerabilities, ass to mouth vulnerabilities, which I think is the best name.
That's crude, but very evocative.
It is, isn't it? I just think that's
just
the best name.
Very evocative.
Them. We've got to make that one stick somehow.
But you know, I mean, these are the problems. These are the problems that caused computer security and operating systems designers to kind of give up on the notion of an operating system that provided separation. Is, you know, you go, well, wow, how are we gonna handle loadable device drivers? How are we gonna handle, you know, hardware profiles? How are we gonna handle all of these problems? And what we need, well, the people who are designing operating systems and the hypervisors need to do, is look where things went wrong with operating systems and say, okay, well, you know, that mistake happened. How did that mistake happen, and what can we do to avoid it? And if the answer is there's nothing we can do to avoid it, then we're going to have, you know what, in a couple of years we're going to have hypervisors. We're going to be running virtual stacks of VMs and VMs. And it's just going to, the stupid is just going to continue.
We'll have VMware Windows.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, how do we, you know, the thing we need to do, and for some reason that I don't understand, computers, you know, the computing world just doesn't do it. We need to look at the mistakes that we made in the past and how we got there, and ask ourselves, you know, what combination of technological and commercial pressures brought us into this particular state? And, you know, are they pressures that we can resist effectively, or are they not? I mean, I was kind of happy to see that, you know, the Google guys are at least claiming that they're running, what is it, Chrome? They're running that under, you know, it's running in its own internal sandboxes, and the plugins are each running in their own internal sandboxes and separate threads.
I saw a presentation by Mark Dowd, who is, of course, very well known when it comes to hacking through browsers. And, you know, he said, look, Chrome at the moment, as it stands, is not really that amazing, but the fundamental design, the way that it works, looks a lot bloody better than anything that we've seen so far. So I guess in 12 months from now, that might actually be a good option for us.
Well, it looks like an operating system, you know, and that's one of the things that's really funny. I was talking to a friend of mine who's an operating system junkie from back in the 70s, you know, and he said, you know, you look at what a browser is doing now. It's got plugins, it's got separate threads, it's got a cache, it manages its own file system in the form of cookies, it is a freaking operating system. I mean, the only thing it doesn't do is have a bootstrap loader.
Mm. Well, doesn't that make it particularly suitable for running in a VM?
Yeah, it does. But, you know, again, this is the kind of thing that I don't really see, you know, I don't see why people are doing this. I mean, well, I do, but, you know, this huge amount of effort that's being spent on building layers of virtual machines, you know, what we really need is we need operating systems that provide these kinds of capabilities. That's what an operating system is supposed to do.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess, too, you know, now that everyone's using all these Web 2.0 services, owning someone's browser, even if it's a VM, it's going to be pretty useful still, so.
Oh, yeah. And it's, you know, so, you know, there's going to be other problems with that, too. I mean, the browsers, you know, how do you restrict the browser so that it can do only the correct things? Can you have a browser that's only allowed to connect out to certain sites and, you know, under certain circumstances and yada, yada, yada? And you know what? The end game there, you know, we need per socket controls on where the browsers can call out to. You know, and the end game there, by the time you're done, is you've just designed a mandatory access control system like you know, people were trying to design for operating systems circa 1983.
Mate, you have a fabulous way of just sucking the optimism right out of me, and I tell you what, every time that we speak, I feel like going off to start a strawberry farm or something like that and just kissing this whole industry goodbye.
Would you like to talk about the banking industry?
Oh, joy, joy, joy. Well, Marcus Ranham, that is actually the last sponsor interview. That is the end of the last sponsor interview for 2008. We're all done. Thank you very much for all of your contributions over 2008, and we'll speak to you next year.
Okay, take care.
And that's it for Risky Business for 2008, our biggest year ever. Thanks to all of you for tuning in each week and making Risky Business such a success. I absolutely love putting this show together for you all every week. And because you keep tuning in, I can. So I wish you all a very happy Christmas and holiday. And I'll be back on deck properly in February. Big thanks to all of our sponsors as well, who've really supported us all through 2008. Until February, I've been Patrick Gray. Merry Christmas.